it makes me feel invincible when I do it. Like I've done all the previous kind of rides, and I was never this mentally strong until I lost a lot of weight, gained confidence, boosted my fitness, and, you know, got it to a really high standard. And, you know, I think it probably comes across sometimes to people quite arrogant, but I'd never mean it to come across like that, but it's just a massive self-confidence that I've got in that, you know, I think I can do pretty much anything that is thrown in front of me.
Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dads show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills, and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics that will captivate you. If you're a first-time listener, we have insightful conversations with people who are truly masters at work and experts in their field. Fascinating individuals, writers, entrepreneurs, and ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, and today we find out how one dad's health and fitness journey started in quite unique circumstances, but would take him on an incredible journey of self-discovery and radically transform what he thought he was capable of, and in the process have a massive impact on the lives of others. Every conversation we have translates the experience and expertise of our guests into practical knowledge you can use to better understand yourself as a dad, and in the process improve your physical health, mental health, relationships, career, and the way in which you show up to the world as a role model to the next generation. We also cover tricky subjects from all angles and viewpoints to give you a new and different perspective. Today's episode tells the story of an ordinary dad just like you and me, and how, when he was faced with his daughter's diagnosis of blindness, his world was turned upside down. But this was the point at which something changed and clicked inside him. My guest today is postman and personal trainer Martin Kelland. As an advocate of helping everyday people get fit and healthy at the same time as enjoying food and embarking on their own journeys, he has first-hand experience having gone through the same process himself. We uncover the deep drivers and survival instincts that drive us to do things we thought were previously impossible. How this builds our confidence and faith in ourselves that we can do things, and why you can do far more than you think. The stories that us dads tell ourselves that we are past it, and the point at which we all need to take better care of ourselves to stack the odds in our favour the older we get. I also uncover with Martin how the part the food industry has to play in triggering our primitive brain for food, and we share our experiences of being dads to girls with special needs. If you ever wonder how some of the amazing guests get to where they are in life that I speak to on a weekly basis, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you will be an amazing company. And now to my conversation with Martin Kelland. Martin, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, not bad, not bad in yourself. We got there in the end with our technical teething problems this evening, but it's always a bit of fun and games when you're dealing with...
It was a bit of a nightmare, but we got there in the end.
I usually speak to people on here and I'm like, I know a little bit about them and I know a little bit about their story sometimes, and quite often it'll be somebody who's kind of across in the States, or it could be someone as local as like Ipswich, like Ben Coomber was the other month, who's obviously a mutual connection of ours. But I know, advanced disclosure to people that are listening and watching this, Martin is actually my trainer at the moment. So he's making sure that I stay on the straight and narrow in terms of my diet and my exercise, which has been thrown off in the last couple of weeks because of my injured finger, which some of you may well have seen on the social media and stuff and that. But yeah, how did you get into this kind of whole thing of health and fitness? Because I know this has not always been the case for you, Martin.
No, so it hasn't. So in my younger years, I played a half decent level of football, mm-hmm. soccer, if anyone in the US is listening to this. And, you know, I was okay at that, but I was quite unfit, quite overweight. My weight used to fluctuate up and down. I was always kind of the laziest when it came to training and stuff like that. And I just didn't really enjoy exercising that at all, really. Mm. But then one day, something kind of happened within my life where I just took myself off out for a run to clear my head. And that just set a chain of events that's led to me where I am now. I'm a qualified personal trainer. I've been one for 6 years. I'm also a postman, and I've been a postman for 22 years. And exercise is a massive part of my life in that now.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I've, you know, come to be where I am now.
And what sort of got you, fired up to start that run? Because that's quite a bold thing to do. If you don't like running, like some people really don't like running, to go on to set off on yeah. your run. What was the thing that prompted that?
I mean, I hate running. Not so much now, but back then, I don't ever think I have probably run a mile without stopping before that. Because even when I was kind of slimmer at school, I used to suffer from asthma. So that was my get out of jail card for doing the long distance run. So my chest is playing up. And running has never been in me, but I had something happen to me. Well, it happened to my little girl, actually. And she was diagnosed as being born blind.
Mm.
And, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks, hit the whole kind of family, my now ex-wife, like a ton of bricks. And I don't know why, but I just thought, I'm just going to go out for a run. I just need to be outside. I need a bit of fresh air, you know, stimulus from the outside world. Went for a run, and I just didn't stop there. That mile became two, then three, then four. Then I ran 10 miles, and I was like, God, you know what? I'm only a couple miles off a half marathon now. I'm going to do the local half marathon and raise some money for her. And so I did. And then it just snowballed on from there. I went to London Marathon and so on.
And I know from running myself that, like, when you get into it after the first sort of kind of couple of miles, you kind of begin, like, people just sort of describe it as that kind of runner's high. But you also, I think, running kind of takes on almost like a meditative effect as the miles go by, because your brain, for me anyway, like my brain used to go off the lead a little bit. So it would kind of begin to wander, and then it would kind of come back, and then you begin to kind of process different things that you're kind of thinking about. And I think you kind of leave it on the road almost to a certain extent. Did you definitely find that the case, or?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
And you have sort of like, sometimes I'd find it like you kind of like forget stuff that's happened like a long time ago. And then, like, for me, you kind of like remember something that's not come to you for a while, or you get like an insight or an idea about something, and then that would go away. And then something else sort of comes in as the kind of miles are ticking by. It almost becomes like that kind of processing effect that you go through.
Yeah, I think what I found when I ran more than anything was that I could feel myself getting fitter. I was losing a bit of weight, not a great amount of weight because my diet still was pretty poor.
Mm.
But I could feel myself getting fitter, and I could feel that I could do something positive. And I could take this situation that was really negative and I could turn it into a positive, and I could run the half marathon and raise money towards Neve or charities that she would be involved in. And that was it for me. That's what kind of spurred me on. It's, you know, it is really good to clear your head when you're going out. You've got all these worries and troubles. We were getting sent around the country for different tests because they didn't know what had caused her to be born blind. And So yeah, it cleared my head, but it also gave me something positive to focus on. And that was the big drive for me in the end, where I could actually turn that negative into something positive.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people find that because there's, you've got so much kind of energy inside you, and you can either use that energy to as a kind of negative force or a positive force, or you can kind of ruminate it, and you can, like, the thoughts in your head, if people ever, you know, get ruminating thoughts where you're thinking about something all the time, you can almost like overanalyze it or analyze the hell out of it, and it just kind of gets you nowhere other than just making you feel more down and kind of depressed and stuff. So how did your, in terms of like the kind of fundraising aspect of it, how did that kind of evolve over time? Because I know that you began to kind of raise money for different causes, along with Neve's cause as well, in terms of kind of getting her the help that she needed as she was getting older and older and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, first up was the local half marathon in Exeter, Devon, which was the Great West Run, and that was raising money towards Neve. Anything that she may need, we would have the money to, you know, provide for her, kind of thing with that. And once I'd done that, I think we raised probably about £5,000 back then. And once that was ticked off, I thought, you know, I've ran 13 miles. What's next? Let's do a marathon. And never did I think I could run a marathon. Honestly, I couldn't even run a bath before I started running, let alone run a mile. And so, yeah, the London Marathon in 2012, I think it was 2011, I raised money for a charity called Victor, which is Visually Impaired Children Taking Action. And I raised about £6,000 or £7,000 for them. And whilst this kind of was going on, where I was going out training for the London Marathon, I got into contact with an old friend of mine, a girl that I went to school with. And I knew that she had a quite severely disabled daughter, but I didn't really know what the problem was. We'd lost contact for a number of years, and you only hear it through kind of other people, you know, that she had been, her daughter, sorry, had, you know, really severely disabled. And I arranged to go around for a cuppa, catch up, and I walked into the room and saw her daughter, Georgia. I spent an hour then. She's the most sweetest, like, girl, about 6 years old at the time. And this was when we were at probably our most worrying point about Neve. We didn't know what the problem was. She was completely blind. You know, it could be something to do with her brain, a tumor or anything. And I looked at Georgia, and I remember leaving the house, and I said to my ex-wife, You think we've got problems? Like, take a look at that girl. And she's got something called Rett syndrome, which affects one in every 100,000 girls. It's a girl-only kind of disorder where it kind of attacks the brain, and the body can't really receive and act on the signals the brain has given it. And so they became locked in a body. But the sad thing is, the brain is actually fully aware of everything around them. And they actually hit all their milestones up until the age of about 2 or 3. So they will crawl, they will walk, they will start speaking. You will think that this is, you know, perfect. I've got my perfect little girl. And then it will start to regress, and it starts going backwards, and they end up getting locked in a body that they cannot control. You know, or there's no control there. And I just thought to myself, over the years, Neve, my daughter, got better. Her sight, she had like some stimulation therapy to bring some sight back, because they found out the issue was brain damage, where her optic nerves were connecting with her brain. And they basically rerouted her brain with stimulation therapy. So she has gained a lot of sight back. And I used to see Georgia every year regressing when Neve was progressing. And it gave me a lot of guilt, really, because her mum, Kate, was really good with us, you know, when it comes to anything to do with form filling and stuff like that, which sounds so kind of minute. But if you see the size of these forms that they give you, and you know, you're in a pretty bad place as it is, the last thing you want to do is go filling them in. But when you've got someone who's been through the process and she would sit down with us for hours, you know, and write it all out, I just thought I just need to do something for Georgia and give something back to her. And so I decided to jump, sort of like grab hold of my brother-in-law, who at the time he was into kind of Ironmans and triathlons and stuff, and he was into his endurance events. And I'd only just been cycling for about 6 months. I just bought a road bike on the bike to work scheme, 750 quid. And I said, I want to do something for Georgia. They're doing a fundraising weekend on this so-and-so weekend. And he said, what have you got in mind? I said, how about cycling down to Land's End from Exeter and back to Land's End in the Wanna? And he said, well, that's 280 mile. Yeah. And I was like, yeah. And he went, yeah, definitely. It can be done.
And 280, not flat miles either. If you ever seen the landscape going from South Devon into Cornwall towards Land's End.
It was 20,000 feet in elevation in climbing. And we set off on the 1 o'clock on the Saturday, on the first fundraising day. We had a support van with us. And it was like the A-team. They would pull up alongside, slide the door open and pass us food and drink, because we literally did not get off those bikes unless we were stopping for bike maintenance, a pee, or we had something, you know, a quick photo down at the actual famous sign in Land's End. Apart from that, it was just non-stop cycling. Yeah. There was no like rest stops or anything like that.
Yeah. Stopping is fatal on two wheels, because once you get comfortable sitting on the grass at the side of the road, you're never going to get up again.
No, not at all. And and we left at 1 o'clock on the Saturday and we returned on the Sunday. No, sorry, we left at 5 o'clock on the Saturday, sorry. And we returned at 1 o'clock on the Sunday. So it was 20 hours, whatever. But actually, we had to go slow on the way back because we were way ahead of schedule. And people were expecting us back at 1 o'clock. And we would have actually got back at 11 with no one there. So we were like, look, we're going to have to drag this out a bit now. And we dragged it out. We got back at 20 past one. There's big celebrations and we had a good night at the end of it as well.
Excellent. And so how did you... One thing I wanted to delve into is how you kind of feel when you're doing this stuff for someone else. Because I know that, you know, I did the Royal Parks half marathon last year I did it in the autumn last year. And what's weird is that kind of like, I'd never done like a big event before. And it kind of like brings kind of tears to your eyes a bit, because like I started it off in the first bit. I don't know how I ended up in the first bit with a lot of the quick guys. But you start and it's just like a wall of noise. And with the raw parts, you kind of go out and down a mile and that, and then you come back into along sort of where the Serpentine is in Hyde Park. And again, you hit this like big old kind of, you know, like wall of noise sort of thing. And then you see all the T-shirts, all the people. So, you know, there'll be Cancer Research, British Heart Foundation, all the kind of bigger ones. And then there'll be kind of smaller little kind of cohorts of people, you know, around the route and stuff. And it kind of hits home when you do this stuff that it's not just, okay, you've done your kind of training for the event, but there's a lot more meaning attached to the event than just you doing your kind of training and stuff. And particularly this year, where a lot of charities have been taking a real hammering because there's just no, a lot of the big events have kind of been cancelled. But, you know, what did you feel like when you were kind of doing events, and you know, how did it make you feel inside to know that what you were doing was kind of potentially making a difference?
Yeah, I don't think I could have done it if I didn't have an emotional connection, obviously, to Niamh and also Georgia, because, you know, the training was extremely like tough and hard, even for the, you know, the marathon. I mean, that was, you know, pretty brutal. I was getting up at 4 o'clock and going for 10 to 15 mile runs sometimes before I was then going to work being a postman, walking around for like 4 or 5 hours. My legs were just broken at the end of it. But I had this plan that was following a training plan, and, you know, I stuck to it like glue. The thought of doing it and giving something back is what kind of really drives me on, but also kind of there is a personal challenge there as well. There is a battle that I'm having in my head where people say, oh, you can't do that, you'll never do that. And I'll be like, no, yeah, I will. And then, you know, I think no disrespect to people who've done marathons and half marathons. They're tough. They're very tough. But a lot of people do them. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people do them. And I just wanted to do something which tested me mentally and physically. You know, I get to raise a huge amount of money. I think we raised another £6,000 for Reverse Rett, which is a charity to do with Rett syndrome. And yeah, I just get to take on that personal like battle, that kind of mind fuck really of can I or can't I do this?
Yeah.
And that is what really gives me like a kick.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I was kind of fatter and overweight, never thought I could do anything like that physically or mentally. And once I've done the half marathon, I was like, well, what else can I do? Marathon, right. What else can I do? What can I do that people cannot do, that thousands of people don't do? Well, actually, yeah, no one rides 280 miles in one hit. No one's stupid enough to do that. You know, not many people anyway.
Yeah.
So that was like, yeah, right. You know, and it was a bit of an eye-opener for me because I didn't really understand cycling at the time, as in distance and elevation and stuff like that, because I'd only had my bike for 6 months. And my brother-in-law, Stu, he was like a seasoned rider. And we actually went and mapped out the route down to Land's End and back with his Garmin so he could program it and we could know exactly where we were going. And on the way back in the car, he said, this has got 20,000 feet of climbing. And I just looked at him and went, yeah, what does that mean? He just, and he was like, this is going to be absolutely brutal. And I was like, all right, you know, didn't think enough of it. You know, we've done the ride and it hurt. It, you know, I won't lie. I had my eyes opened and there were points where I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. You know, at certain points you do have those kind of low moments, but that's what I like. I like that battle in my head. And that is what kind of turns me on in a way, I guess, really. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And I think the thing is it's quite a good analogy for life as well, doing those kind of longer events, because they are like almost like a microcosm for life in some respects, because you don't really know what's kind of coming next, and you don't know what it's going to be around the next bend and how you're going to feel a few more miles down the road and stuff and that. And it's a really good analogy for life, because you know, you don't really know what's coming next, and you kind of, if you stress about what's coming next, it doesn't kind of change what's coming next. It's just coming next. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And
and
I think that's kind of why when you get into those kind of realms of doing that longer stuff, it just, the mindset kind of becomes different, and it does become very much like a microcosm for like the kind of wider world and what you're kind of going through and stuff and that. So definitely.
Yeah. I mean, as much as it was hard, it didn't put me off trying something else. I mean, I wasn't finished there kind of thing. After that, I really kind of got into my cycling after that. And I saw a challenge pop up online called Everesting, where basically you just go in, take any hill in the world and you rep it repeatedly until you match the same height as Mount Everest. And I was like, lads, this is like 30,000 feet of climbing. We've done 20. Who's in? And Stu, my brother-in-law, was like, yeah, I'm in. He's just mad anyway. He loves it. And we got a couple other friends as well to come and join us. And we set up the next ride, and it was called Ride for Georgia, Part 2, Everesting. And that was absolutely savage. I won't, like, shy away from that. I mean, that was 22 hours, 190 miles, and 30,000 feet of climbing. And everyone, see, people, non-cyclists, don't understand, like, distance and elevation. They went, oh, it's only 190 though, but you've done 280 before. And I'm like, you don't understand, but we've done 30,000 feet of climbing and it's compressed into that 190. So we're not getting a long periods of time on any flat surface to let our legs recover. It is just up and down. And they're like, oh yeah, I kind of get it now. And it was.
Yeah. And the downside to that probably is you're getting cold coming back down. And then you're going to spend the first kind of mile or so warming back up until you get into find your rhythm again. If you can find a rhythm after 100 odd miles of doing that continuously, sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I did find that, you know, with getting cold and that on the way down. And we done it in September 2015. And we couldn't have picked a better day for it as well, because it was nice. It was sunny. There was no wind at all. We didn't have any headwind or anything like that. And we've done it on Dartmoor in Devon, a hill called Hatel Vale, which is quite famous because famous is in, you know, the Tour of Britain and that.
Yeah,
they race up there. Yeah, they race up there and finish up there. And so if we're going to do it on a hill, we wanted something iconic. So we thought, yeah, we'd do it there. And so we raised another £7,000, I think, for George's charity then.
Yeah.
With that ride. And, you know, that was incredible. And it makes me feel invincible when I do it. Like I've done all the previous kind of rides, and I was never this mentally strong until I lost a lot of weight, gained confidence, boosted my fitness, and, you know, got it to a really high standard. And, you know, I think it probably comes across sometimes to people quite arrogant, but I'd never mean it to come across like that, but it's just a massive self-confidence that I've got in that, you know, I think I can do pretty much anything that is thrown in front of me.
Yeah. And I think it's once you begin to prove yourself, it's a mental battle that you have with yourself more than anything else, isn't it? Because like once you kind of begin to kind of prove to yourself more than anyone else that you can do something, then the kind of walls that you kind of built up around yourself begin to kind of come down one by one, because you're like, actually, if I can do that, then I can probably do this. And I think one of the things I think we've, you know, and I posted about this today on social media, I think one of the things that with dads in particular and guys that are kind of getting into this kind of 30 to 45 age group, I guess, you know, there is a tendency to think that our best days are behind us and we're not going to get up to the dizzy heights that we were when we were kind of younger and stuff and that. And, you know, and those days of, you know, your parents saying, oh, you can be everything you want to be and you can do anything you want to do, like, seem like a long and distant memory. And you get, I think it's natural for middle-aged guys to kind of talk themselves out of the stuff that they think that they can't do anymore. But then in actual fact, when they sort of, okay, you're not probably going to get into shape as quick as an 18 or 19 year old would. But once you start gradually building the momentum up, it's almost becomes like a bit of a juck. There's not really much holding you back once you kind of get this stuff under your belt.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And you just said the word that I was going to say, momentum. Once you start something and you build on it and you build that momentum, you know, I was probably in my best shape in my 30s up until now, and I'm 41. I was in far better shape than when I was in my 20s.
Mm.
And that just shows that age is just a number when it, you know, comes to what we can do and what we can achieve as we get older and into our 30s, 40s and 50s, where, like you say, we think that we're past it to a certain extent, that we've had our best time, and we haven't at all.
No.
You know, and there are so many guys out there that I just wish they could eat more healthier and exercise a bit more, but just in a slower, sustainable way, where they'll see slower, gradual changes to their health and fitness, and then they will build on that momentum. But, you know, as human beings, we always want to go for that quick fix and that shortcut. And it doesn't exist, unfortunately, when it comes to fitness and weight loss. You know, I mean, yeah, if you want to lose weight for a photo shoot or a wedding or a holiday and you want to do it in 4 weeks, yeah, that quick fix will help you. But aside of that, you will probably put all the weight back on and more afterwards. And this is the trap that, you know, not just men fall into, women as well. And that is what really kind of, I bang my head against the wall and I just wish I could change people's mindsets. And slowly I think I am with, you know, my business and what I'm posting online and stuff, and people are messaging and like, I get it now. I get it. You know what you're saying, and that there is no quick fix, and just take it slow and steady.
Yeah. And I think two things come to kind of a juncture as well. And we've, you know, we've talked about this just this week, you know, off this call, you know, the kind of Joe Wicks effect and the motivation behind why people are doing stuff, you know, and particularly this year in 2020, we've seen like that massive push where everyone's working out in April and May, and they've kind of fallen off the wagon again, you know, similar to what people do in the new year and stuff, because they've not got that strong why behind what they're doing it. Now, you know, I think there's kind of maybe a couple of elements to that. There's the kind of habits and how you've kind of grown up with and your eating habits. And, you know, we've talked about, I've talked to you about how I kind of, I probably under eat in some respects and then binge eat in other respects. A big part of it for me has actually been keeping those consistent energy levels. But also, you know, when my old man passed away in 2015, you know, he passed away of a stroke. My grandparents all had heart disease. So I think you reach an age as well where, you know, like when you're in your 18, 19 and 20, you're kind of like, yeah, I'm just going to drink Coca-Cola. I'm going to live fast. And, you know, you're going to live fast and eat fast and drink. You know, everything is kind of like, you know, bodily abuse, if that makes any sense. And then I think you get to a point where, you know, okay, you may have had a friend that's got cancer or a relative that's got cancer or some other kind of chronic disease or ailment or whatever it's going to be. And the kind of grim reaper comes knocking a little bit and you're kind of like, hang on a minute, he's got a bit close over there and he's kind of got close over there and I'm not as young as I used to be and my parents succumbed to this and this. And you kind of like, so for me personally, now I'm kind of like, well, actually, you know, I need to not be like paranoid and turn into this kind of like total health freak where I'm kind of like only eating like, you know, a plant-based diet and all this stuff, but just becoming more aware of the fact that actually I do need to keep moving. I do need to keep my energy levels up. And I do, the strong reason behind this is I want to see my grandkids grow up or certainly get to a decent age before I check out of this world. But I don't know, I think some people look in the mirror now and they think that's too hard for me to do that, so I'm just not even going to try anymore. You know what I mean? And that's tragic in some respects, that you don't think enough about yourself that you want to be around, or certainly stack the odds in your favour that you're going to be around as long as you can. You know what I mean? Gents, I'm going to quickly jump in here because I have an exciting announcement. If you have tuned in for any period of time or have grabbed a copy of my book, The Dad Blueprint, you'll be familiar with my journey and why I started Guild of Dads. I discuss how I struggled by myself for a long time before I had the good fortune to get around other men on a similar journey to me, which is when my life really changed for the better. Which is why I'm excited to announce that I've built my own community of men and dads called the Dad's Circle, which opens its doors in January, and I'm looking for 20 men like you to become founder members at a special lifetime rate of just £40. But you'll need to get in now, because once these spots are filled, the monthly subscription is £80 a month. So what do you get? A private members area. This is a bespoke area where you can set up a customized profile away from any social media, so you can link up with other men and share ideas, suggestions, insights and strategies to help you succeed, leaving you more time to focus on the things and the dad you always wanted to be. Weekly virtual Zoom sessions in which you'll have an opportunity to join others to discuss a monthly topic so you can share experiences and gain insight about yourself from the comfort of your own home. A copy of my ebook, The Dad Blueprint. This book takes you chapter and verse through my own journey, but also the secret system I used in order to radically change my life. This includes a proven 12-week method and shortcuts to systemize your development, so no more chaotically trying to change by yourself. There'll also be weekly virtual team calls in which you'll share your wins and losses for the week and be held accountable for keeping to your objectives and tactics to achieve them so that your growth is supercharged from day one and you're no longer doing this alone. We record all calls because I recognise that you can't be everywhere at once, so all the calls are recorded, meaning you can access content at your convenience anytime at your own pace and not feel overwhelmed. We have monthly topics in which we'll explore a different topic monthly, which means you get to grow, learn and build your knowledge of yourself and others in a supportive environment. There'll also be physical and mental challenges. Many of us are living in a comfort zone now and you can achieve far more than you think. By engaging in challenges, you're able to see beyond what you thought was possible for yourself and grow in confidence and accomplishment. The other thing is that you'll have access to a 12-week battle plan, which is a proven powerful system to help you identify where you want to go in life and how you get there, along with tracking resources. This means no more chaotically trying to improve here, there and everywhere. Along with the growing library of resources, including books, videos, documents and also other podcasts, there is no limit to the amount of things that you're going to have access to. The best bit of it all is that there's no contract. So if for any reason you find that the Dad Circle is not for you, then you can leave at any time, no questions asked. If it's not for you, there's no obligation to stay. If you want in, spots are filling fast, and once the waiting list is full for this early bird offer for lifetime membership at £40, that's it. To put your name down, simply email me, joe@guildofdads.com, as it will be first come, first serve for when the doors open in January. I look forward to seeing you on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a friend of mine who I used to train a couple of years ago, and he's massively overweight, and he's just had twins. And he is, 40 years old now? And he's one of these people, like, he struggles to stick with his exercise, his diet. He's got outside influences that I would say derail him a lot. And, you know, I pulled him to one side and I said, look, I mean this in a serious kind of conversation, because he's a bit of a joker as well and a bit of a lad. And I said, you've got twins. The way you're living your life and how overweight you are probably going to have a stroke, heart attack, and your twins will be babies probably, you know, they will be toddlers the way you're going. And he's not a serious person at all. And I could see that it just kind of, the penny dropped in his head at that point. And he was like, yeah. And then he told me where to go afterwards. And give me a bit of stick in that. But, you know, it's quite sad because I don't train him now because he actually moved away. And from what I gather, he still hasn't kind of changed his lifestyle and the way he lives. And, as you know, I worry for him because, you know, right, we could be wrong. Some people can live to 80, 90, but the science out there and the statistics show that if you are obese and overweight, you have more chance of heart disease, you know, strokes and even cancers to some extent. And, you know, you're not putting the odds in your favor. And it's just, you know, I just wish I could help him and lots of other people, because sometimes they think it's really hard and they give up too easy. Whereas it's not actually that hard, you know, the actual kind of, it's quite simple. You know, we know what to eat, we know what to do, but the hard part is your environment, the people who you surround yourself with. Are they going to support you? I know people that used to try and like diet, like lads, friends of mine, and their missus would get actually jealous if they started to lose weight because they couldn't, and they would go out and get takeaways and stuff. And they'd end up putting all the weight back on and that, and, you know, and that's not a great environment to diet in, is it? You know, and And there's so many other, you know, so many factors around like weight loss and dieting, apart from the food that we eat, that people need to nail. And this is the kind of area that I'm looking into now. I mean, I could hand people a bit of paper of what to eat. I could put it in a TV advert on a billboard. But, you know, people just struggle kind of with, you know, their outer environment, I think. And mm-hmm. that is what I think the problem is with obesity mm-hmm. and the way people overeat and become fat at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing is as well is I think a lot of the kind of mentality around it as well, and I hear this more so, you know, I probably hear this more so when women are talking about dieting more so than men maybe, you know, and you hear stuff like, oh, it's my metabolism, or it's this, or it's that, or there's, you know, all the kind of usual excuses that there are sort of thing and stuff. But it's, you know, I realised this when I was on the M25 and I pulled off at a service station at, I think it's Cobham, the one over, the newer one on the southern stretch of the M25. And you drive in to that place, and literally as you're driving in, as you drive into the car park where the services are, there is just like boards up along the side of as you drive into the car park. So there'll be like one for KFC, one for Burger King, another one. So basically, before you even get into the place, there is like, you know, your dopamine pump is being primed for a hit before you even get to the car park. And then you come out of the car park, and even if you want to go to the toilets are right at the back of the services. So you have to walk past Starbucks, past Costa, past KFC, past Burger King, past, I don't know, Waitrose, Marks and Spencers. And then if you're lucky, you can get to the toilet without buying something. And then you have to do the same thing on the way back. So the whole experience is designed to prime your dopamine pump. So that you cannot resist getting out of there without buying something which is going to give you a hit. You know what I mean? And it's when you realize the whole architecture of this place is built to give you a hit, you just don't stand a chance against that.
Yeah, they know exactly what they're doing. I would say for anyone listening to this, there's a great book out there from someone called Stefan Guiney, and he's from America, and he wrote a book called The Hungry Brain. And he is a neurologist, but he studies obesity as well, and it's all to do with the our brain circuits, basically. And our brains are still wired up like they were hundreds and thousands of years ago when food wasn't around. So when we try to diet now, our brain doesn't like that. It starts putting things in place with our hormones and lots of other, like, you know, mechanics within our body that will try to counteract us losing weight, because it thinks that we might starve. And this was brilliant, you know, years ago when we were cavemen. But now, like you say, in the environment that we've got, where we're walking around and there's KFC, McDonald's, you know, we know we're not going to starve because we can just drive down the road and get KFC. And our brain doesn't know that, though, you know, the way it's wired in and programmed in. And, you know, your brain gives no fucks whatsoever that you want to lose weight and you want to look good in your bikini or your Speedos on holiday.
I don't wear Speedos anymore. No, I'm 41. I don't wear Speedos anymore. Trust me.
Bankini. But yeah, and this is it. And his book is brilliant. And there's a lot of strategies in there around how you can kind of counteract the environment that is around us now. And this is where I go on about again. You know, it's our environment where we slip up when it comes to dieting. And yeah, I mean, those service stations are just, like you said, they're primed to just trigger that dopamine. Mm. And, you know, your mouth will start watering and drooling and stuff like that. I mean, he was saying there's something in his book that you probably can't remember this. I certainly can't. But the first time you ever ate a pizza, your brain, because of the food and how nice it tasted, you were like, oh my word. That is amazing. Your brain instantly remembers how good that was, where you got it from, how to access it, like kind of, and then when you kind of get a cue to, if you get a bit of, you know, you're getting hungry and you see a Domino's pizza leaflet on the table, that is your cue and your brain will then, you can get a bus to go in there, get that. And it remembers, and it happens a lot, like subconsciously as well. And you won't have any control over it at all. So you have really got to be kind of on your toes, on your guard when you're dieting around that kind of external environment that kind of sucks you in.
Yeah. I remember my old man saying about, they'd done a study into like, and they'd studied people's, you know, like in McDonald's where you have those big, where you have the menus above the desk, and they did a study into people watching the pupils dilating as people walk up and they see the menu, the pupils dilate, and they realize that the pupils were dilating in exactly the same way as someone who's about to get a hit of cocaine. Exactly the same way, because your brain is expecting to get that hit, sort of thing. It's just absolutely kind of mental sort of thing to just to kind of think that. But I covered this with a previous guest in terms of like Calpol, because you just don't really, and this is going to seem like way out there, but I just never really thought about this. You just give your kids Calpol when they're little, but it's basically paracetamol with a nice little sugar, with a nice little hit of sugar. You know, and then you get, and I think for our generation, like sort of like, you know, the kids that were brought up in like the 80s and stuff, it was very much the kind of the first of the sort of convenience generation. So, you know, kids would be given biscuits to keep them quiet, and you had rusks, and you had all this kind of stuff around kind of, you know, what particularly children were eating. And I think our generation is very much a lot of the time it's kind of, well, it was all right for us. It didn't do us any harm, sort of thing. But instinctively, we know that probably giving kids too many biscuits and too much stuff that's kind of, you know, quite calorific is probably not good for their insides and stuff. But it's just a fascinating... The science behind it is mad, absolutely mad.
Yeah, it is. And the problem is when kind of the older generation say, oh, you know, we could eat that back in our day and we never got fat or overweight and stuff like that. And what you've got to remember is not only kind of is that food environment around us that tries to suck us in, like you say, with all the fast food outlets and the way they market and promote themselves. Also, we are a lot more static as a species now. You know, years ago, you know, my mum and dad and their mum and dad, the mum wouldn't have a car, so she would be walking everywhere, walking to the shops, carrying shopping around. She'd be more active. You know, the men would be manual workers and they'd be more active. And so, you know, that made a huge difference back then, why obesity wasn't around so much all those years ago, but it is now. You know, and, you know, back in our day, we, you know, we were never overweight and fat, and we could eat chocolate and never done us any harm.
Yeah. Yeah, but and I think as well, there's something that occurred to me recently is also schools as well, because, you know, I went to the local primary school, and then the only deciding factor for secondary school was, well, what school did your brother or your sister go to? And then you go to that one, sort of thing. But generally, that's not a kind of close thing. But now you have this whole thing of catchment areas. So you will have parents driving their kids across a borough or across a county to get to school. Whereas like, when we were growing up, you'd be walking to school. So, you know, my walk to school was 2 miles there and 2 miles back. So I was walking 4 miles a day. And you didn't, yeah. You don't think about that till you like start working and you drive into work and stuff. And you're like, why have I put on a bit of weight? And you sort of think, actually, it's because I'm not walking 4 miles a day, 5 days a week.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that with kids and that, you know, but that's a real good point. It is, yeah. They just get chauffeured around now instead of like walking or riding their bike.
Yeah, and that's a kind of almost product of the kind of Ofsted thing where you know, where it's all done on league tables. But you didn't have that when we were growing up. So you just, do we like school? Yeah, it's okay. Can they get a bus to it and walk a bit of it? Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. That'll be the school, sort of thing. And then you kind of like, well, you know, it's a pain getting the bus. It's just quicker if I walk the whole way there. I think a lot of kids reach that conclusion within a couple of years. and you're not getting like chewing gums and crisps and fag packets thrown at you on the top deck of the bus either. So it becomes an easier proposition. And people listen to this like, what? You could smoke on buses? Yeah, you could. You could in the 90s, you could smoke on the top deck of a bus. Yeah.
Yeah, I was lucky. I never had to get the school bus. Never had to run the gauntlet of that.
We've touched upon in our conversation, Martin, like some of the fun and games, and I say that lightly, fun and games of having a child with kind of special needs and stuff. How did you find that? Because like my eldest is autistic and she's on the spectrum, so we have had our fair share of fun and games kind of with the system, if you like. But again, like to your point of, oh, there's always someone that's kind of worse off than us, or so you kind of, in your mind, you kind of work out where you are in the kind of, should I feel grateful or should I not feel grateful kind of scheme of things. But how did you find that? Because I know that's one thing that is the tormentor of people who have got kids that have extra needs, whether it be autism or whether it be another kind of disability that other kids don't have. How did you find circumnavigating that system?
Yeah, I mean, the system I'm currently going through at the moment, because not only has Neve got her disabilities with her sight, she is also in the process of being diagnosed as autistic.
Mm.
She blatantly is. You know, the process isn't finished yet, but they've already said to us, she 100% this, she is autistic. I've been saying it for years, and I've been banging on the door of the system for years, and they were like kind of linking her kind of delayed kind of learning and like learning difficulties to her sight and stuff, which she is going to have obviously problems and she is going to be behind because of her sight. But I was like, no, there's something else that isn't quite right here. And it's not until the last 2 years that now it just sticks out like a sore thumb. And yeah, so we're going through the system at the moment. So I'm not quite probably where you are with that, but it's like banging your head against a brick wall. Because I was going to go in, get her privately diagnosed, but they don't accept a private diagnosis. And you're nodding your head. I can see you.
Yeah, I know.
Cameron, like, I just cannot get my head around that, because, you know, if you or I have a bad back and we want it seen to quickly and we go to a private clinic and pay privately, then brilliant. We're happy to do that. It doesn't clog up the system. You see the same experts as what you will see anyway, but you'll see them quicker. And that's the same, I would have thought, with the autism, but it's not.
Yeah.
And they just don't accept it. And they could see the same person, what they will privately or whether they go through the system. And, you know, we were trying to get the process sped up because she's just about to go into secondary school next year. And we want her to go to a specialist school. And there's every chance that she may not get into this specialist school. So we wanted kind of everything in our arsenal. You know, it doesn't bother me whether she's autistic or not. She's my daughter. She's Neve at the end of the day. But to get her in this school, I wanted to drive that forward a bit quicker. But, you know, it's all being held up in that now. But fortunately, I think we have got enough to get her in this school by them just seeing how she is at the moment without even actually being officially diagnosed. Because, I mean, she struggles. She's got a mental age of probably a 6-year-old and she's 11 years old now. And it's tough. It's really like kind of heartbreaking to watch, because like you touched on just now, I mean, other people were worse off than you. And so that always is a real good leveler to me of where I am with my daughter and her needs. And I'm like, God, you know what? She's not like Georgia. But at the same time, we all have our own bubble that we're in to worry about. And that doesn't go away just because someone else is worse off than you. And so you know, I really struggled. I struggled with my mental health probably the last couple of years, because I've seen, you know, I've looked into the future of what it will probably look like for Niamh, and I can't ever see her living independently because she's so mentally behind. And, you know, there are a lot of kids out there that are blind or partially sighted, and they will live independently. And, you know, I know my sister-in-law's dad is completely blind. He lost his sight at 12 years old. He's a remarkable guy. And he lives independently with his wife, who's also severely sight impaired. But, you know, they've, I don't know what's the word, the right word to use, but they're switched on in the brain mentally, you know, where Niamh isn't, where she will be very vulnerable for people to manipulate her or anything like that. And so that is what I struggle with, like seeing her future and what it holds for her, really, and worry about it. And, you know, there are other reasons which I have briefly discussed with you, which I won't go into on here, as to why and how I think her disability came about. And, you know, sometimes in life, it is just one of those things. However, with her, I don't believe it is one of those things. I believe there is blame at someone's doorstep. And I struggle with that because, you know, I still have to see that person constantly, weekly. And, you know, that it's really like hard for me to deal with. And that's what I really, really kind of struggle with as well.
And I think the thing is with all, again, with a lot of parents that have got kids that have got difficulties, it's kind of, it's that future, looking into the future can sometimes be like a real kind of tormentor, because you just don't, you can't. And I think the reason for this is because from the number of people that I've interviewed and what I know about men and how they're different to women and the male psyche, the masculine compared to the feminine, is that I think there is a natural hardwired tendency in men to want to fix. We want to fix. We want to put stuff right. We want to make stuff right. We want to make sure everything's going to be all right. We want to be able to reassure and say, this is going to be okay and stuff. And I think what blows a lot of guys' minds is this concept of, actually, I can't fix this, or I can't make this right, or I can't, there's a limit to what I can do about this. And I think that's, for guys, I think that is possibly one of the most emasculating things that you can go through, because you're just like, I should be able to sort this out. I should be able to do something about this, or I should be able to make this better or make it right. But I can't. And I don't know how to deal with that fact that I bloody well can't. And it's fucking frustrating. Sorry, pardon my French on here, listeners. But it's frustrating. And it's, and you know, you want to sort of throw stuff at walls and scream and get angry and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's, you know, I touched upon it with a previous guest, that the kind of incidence of kind of divorce and separation with parents of children who have special needs, whatever those special needs are, is high. It puts a massive amount of stress on everyone in the family unit, and it's a lonely place as well, I think, for just the family unit, but also individuals in the family unit, because your people, like friends and family, will go, they'll try and understand, but they don't really kind of quite get it. And, you know, particularly with autism and autistic kids, there is a stigma attached to it. So often, particularly older generation, it'll be, well, they just need more discipline, or they just need a firm hand, or they need this, or they need that. And you're just like, no, it's a little bit more than that. And I think that's the kind of journey us parents of kids go through, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's so, like you say, frustrating, because we do want to fix it, and that is what we try to do. And I've probably never come across anything in my life like this, because I've always been able to sort things out, you know, but this you can't. And so that's, it is really kind of tough. There's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, I have to take the positives out of it as well, because she is the happiest girl you could ever see. You know, her world is very small. It's very black and white. She will gallop around on a little horse on a stick, pretending she's like show jumping and stuff. And she's always got a smile on her face. It's very rare that, you know, she's kind of down. And I, you know, I joke around and say, "Oh, Niamh, you're so gorgeous." And she's, "I know, Daddy."
I'm modest.
Yeah, and she genuinely believes it. And, you know, I used to say to her, I've got to stop saying it now, because when she was a bit younger, I used to say, "Who is the most beautiful girl in the world?" And she, "Well, that is me, obviously." And she genuinely means it, because we obviously used to tell her that so much. And, but like, yeah, it's just, I've got to step away from that now, because obviously as she gets older and stuff, like, you know, people don't understand it, because they don't, you know, when we're out and about and stuff like that, she's very quirky and she's got her own little ways and stuff like that. But she's lived in such a happy little world that part of me is quite glad that she doesn't get to see kind of the dark side of our world that we live in, you know, all the bad things that happen.
Yeah.
And she doesn't really understand any of that.
Mm.
And that's quite nice. I mean, and that's in itself, that is quite a gift as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can relate to that, because my daughter, she doesn't, like, she's at secondary school now, and, you know, she's not a girly girl. She's kind of a bit of a tomboy, and, you know, all of the kind of the girls are kind of getting into the, you know, they're getting into the TikTok and the, you know, texting and makeup and who fancies who and all this kind of stuff and whatever. But it just goes straight over her head, and there's still that kind of innocence there that you kind of, like, you know, she just really doesn't get involved with it. A lot of it just kind of goes over her head. But at the same time, you know, at the moment, it means that she's not getting caught up in all that, you know, the kind of the inevitable bitchiness and arguments and clickiness and all that kind of stuff, which I never experienced. You know, with boys, it's kind of different. It's just a different kind of setup. But I'm sure my youngest daughter will probably go through that. But yeah, that kind of innocence is kind of, it's just something to kind of behold, isn't it? Sort of thing. It's for dad, it's kind of like, she's going to be my little girl for just a little bit longer. Do you know what I mean? Sort of thing. So.
Yeah, definitely.
We sound like two old farts here, sort of regaling our growing up and whatever and stuff. But yeah, no, she's looks a lovely little girl from the pictures that I've seen of her. And I know you went to the Creeley Park the other day, which was a bit of a blast in the past for me, because I've been there years and years ago, and I was scared to bejesus going down the dinghy ride. I was like,
another one. We've got a bloody annual pass for that place. So, like, I get dragged along there, like, every other weekend when I have the kids. But I never used to mind taking her, because I would go on the rides with her. But now she's a bit more independent. She's like, "Oh, no, you can just stay there and watch." And I'm just stood there. Sometimes it's like peeing down the rain, freezing cold. And I'm just stood there like a spare part. I'm just like a chauffeur, really. That takes her along and she has a fun old time, and I just take her back.
Yeah. You see, you just got to do the dad thing, haven't you? You just got to start. Right. I'll just stand there. I'll go and get a coffee. Just wait. Let me go and get a coffee. Then you can go on the thing and I'll watch you from the bottom. Whatever that thing is.
That sounds like me all over.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you this evening. We've kind of covered quite a lot of stuff from your kind of epic feats and your journey that you've been on with Niamh, and we've extolled the virtues of kind of health and fitness and stuff. Martin, if people want to find out about you and, you know, the stuff that you're doing, the work that you're doing with everyday people to kind of turn them into elite level athletes or actually whatever they want to be. I sent you a picture of who I want to look like. Well, we won't reveal his name on here, but yeah, you've got an idea of where I want to be going. Don't know whether I'll maintain that forever, but you know, it's...
Boris Johnson.
No, we definitely don't do politics on this. Definitely. I try and veer away from politics. but if people want to get in touch with you or find out a bit more about you, what is the best way for them to do so, Martin?
So on Instagram, I am Martin with a Y, spelt the posh way, _Kelland. Martin _ the everyday athlete. What am I on about? I'm just giving me a personal one then. So yeah, Martin _ the everyday athlete, and on Facebook, the everyday athlete. And what I kind of preach and practice is that we are just, the majority of us anyway, are just everyday people. And we all have an inner athlete inside of us, not where we're going to be an elite athlete, but we can be the best that we can be. And we can enjoy life a lot more. We can become a lot more fitter and a lot more healthier. And at the same time, we can still have a good social life with that. I wouldn't want anyone to think that I am one of these kind of trainers that is an all or nothing. I am far from that. I love a curry. I love a few pints. Those foods and drinks are a part of our, you know, lifestyle, I believe, and they're there to be enjoyed. And I kind of teach people how to live a healthier life and how to include those foods and drinks that tie us together socially. And yeah, just how to include them into people's lifestyles and have fun with them, live fitter and healthier.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'm your
website is on its way. The website is actually being built at the moment. So that will be the everydayathlete.co.uk.
Excellent. And what I'll do is, if that comes about, I'll link that up in the show notes and stuff, and that so people can find that in the episode show notes and stuff. One last question for you, sir. You might have heard this on the other podcast that I've done, but I'm not too sure if you have. What is it that gives you meaning in life, Martin?
What is it that gives me meaning? I didn't hear the end of that one, so... Meaning. My children. Definitely. 100%. And also me. I give myself meaning, I think, you know, when you've asked that, actually. Yeah, me as well as my kids. Mm. Because I want to live a meaningful life. And I can only do that kind of if I believe in myself and I believe in the things what I'm doing.
Excellent. I love it. And I think from our conversation tonight, you've kind of demonstrated how and also kind of the why of the different things that you do and the different things that drive you forward and stuff. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate your frank words on the different subjects we've spoken about tonight and, you know, the work you're doing to change other people's lives through the fitness and the journey and the experience that you've been on yourself. So, Martin, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, man. Take care. Thank you, Martin Kelland, for talking to me today and sharing his experience and insight with me. You can check him out over Instagram and Facebook. His handle is @TheEverydayAthlete. I'll link all this up in the show notes along with all the other stuff we discussed over at guildofdads.com. As dads, we all go through similar journeys, and surprisingly, the one thing I hear from dads more than anything else is self-doubt and whether they think they're worthy. Exercise and fitness challenges, together with the strong reason behind why you are doing them, are quite often the kickstarter to massive personal growth for many dads. You lose weight, you gain confidence, and mentally and physically, you accomplish things you never thought possible. That self-doubt and worthiness question begins to drop away along with limitations you put on yourself. My conversation with Martin is testament to that fact. Lifting the lid off what us dads of children, especially girls with special needs, go through was important, because for a lot of dads, couples and families, most of what they go through simply isn't seen by the outside world. So it's important to bring it out into the open. There's also a video of this interview over on the Guild of Dads YouTube channel, and you can link up with me over on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook using the handle @GuildofDads. I'm teaching you how to follow a simple system and plan, just like many of my guests, in order to transform all areas of your life so that you can live more purposefully with much greater fulfillment and meaning, at the same time as becoming the man and dad you always wanted to be. It's all in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint. You can grab it free at guildofdads.com/dad. In order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves and inspire others to do the same. The fee for this show is that you share it with others so that they may benefit from anything you find useful or interesting. If you know someone that could do with improving their relationship, could do with a life rethink or difference of perspective, share this episode with them. The best bit, you don't have to tell them why you're sharing it with them, but it could be just what they need to hear. Hopefully you find something insightful in every episode, so share with dads you know, and in the meantime, live a life of vision, action and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.